Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Gerald Pollack for the second time. Gerald is a professor of bioengineering at the University of Washington. He is the founding editor-in-chief of the journal Water, executive director of the Institute for Venture Science, and founder of the annual conference on the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. In our previous discussion, Gerald and I focused primarily on the characteristics of water in biological systems. In this conversation, we went deeper into the broad-reaching implications of his discoveries and what this means for scientific investigation in general. We speak about whether cell membranes are represented accurately in textbooks, how cells use ATP to generate energy, and the role of charge in cellular function, and much, much more. I encourage you to listen to our first conversation, episode number 2 of the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast, if you haven't already. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Gerry, thank you so much for joining me again and giving me some of your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Happy to be with you.
I wanted to start by asking you a question about my Schauberger double egg vortexer. And when I use it, clearly something about the water changes, but I have a very hard time trying to explain to people what it does. So I was wondering if you could maybe give me some insight as to what you think happens when water is being vortexed back and forth in one of those devices.
Well, Schauberger referred to it as living water. And, Schauberger was... He was a naturalist. He was not a scientist, and so the language that he uses is really a language that's foreign to so many of us. And
yeah,
his wisdom had to be translated by people who are kind of bridging the gap. And so, if I present my thoughts on what's going on, I would say that when you vortex the water, it creates easy water. And I don't know of any evidence to support that point of view, but we're now looking at vortexed water to see if indeed easy water is produced. I think it is. Preliminary results are in, but we still need to do some controls to be really sure that what we have. So if I have to guess, and this is purely a guess because we're not absolutely sure, I would say that vortexing creates easy water. You know, it's really hard to understand when you have a vortex, the shape of the vortex. It's not so easy to explain if you just presume that everything is ordinary liquid water. But if you think about the surface of the vortex being easy water, then it becomes perhaps, it's like sort of a membrane. It becomes a bit easier to understand what might be going on. So that's my take. It's surprising that there's not more evidence that speaks to that issue, but apparently there's not much evidence, at least that I've found. So that's the best I can do.
It's been very interesting to me. I also assumed that there was some sort of charge separation going on, because when you drink it after it's been vortexed, you know, when you try and put two south poles of a magnet together and they kind of repel, it feels like the water is doing that to the inside of your mouth. It feels like a bubble inside of your mouth. And I've given this water to a lot of people who have no idea about any of this stuff, and they say it's definitely changed the texture of the water. And I've done it with wine also, and it makes the wine taste quite incredible. So clearly it's doing something, but I have a hard time explaining to people what's really going on. But yeah, I think there is some sort of charge separation event going on leading to this sort of magnetic feel in the mouth.
Well, magnetic fields. I'm not sure I would understand exactly how they produce magnetic fields, but...
Oh, I just meant magnetic feel, like it feels like a magnet in your mouth, not so much...
Okay, yeah, not specifically magnetic fields, but yeah, if you were to put a magnet in your mouth. But magnets, you know, we did some experiments with magnets, and if you put magnets into water, you drop a magnet in the water, and we found that next to the North Pole, an EZ forms, and next to the South Pole, an EZ forms. We were quite surprised by that result, but we repeated it many times, and we published it. And apparently something is going on there with magnets that are, I mean, real magnets that is unexpected. And, you know, and so there are lots of reports about magnets being used for health purposes. And I could imagine the possibility that if you put a magnet near the body in some way, an external magnet, that the magnet will induce easy water next to whatever pole is nearest the body. And easy water is very important for health. If you're deficient in easy water, then your cells, which are ordinarily, when they're healthy, they're filled with easy water. But otherwise, if they're not filled, then your health is compromised and your cells are dysfunctional. They're not as functional as they otherwise would be.
Well, that's a great sort of segue into something I wanted to ask you about, which was the idea of cell membranes and the membranes being the divider between the inside and the outside. And that's why there's this sort of this charge gradient. And I think it's quite well established that as we age, the charge inside the cell drops. And it seems like our ability to maintain this charge is what helps us age gracefully. And in Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, you talk about this problem that we have with the membrane, where if you were to cut the membrane, the charge doesn't necessarily go away instantly as you would expect with all the ions flowing out to equilibrium. Something else is going on, not just the membrane. And I find it quite interesting in the book, you say that if the protein portion of the membrane was found first, we would probably speak of the membrane in terms of a protein membrane instead of a lipid membrane. And it's just one of those serendipitous things that just sort of depends on when things are discovered. But I wanted to get your ideas, because that book was written over 20 years ago now. What are your current ideas about what the cell membrane really is and what functions it's performing?
The reason I'm hesitating is that I have given that a lot of thought. And, you know, the original idea was that the inside of the cell, the contents of the inside and the contents of the outside differ, and therefore there must be a membrane. And at that time, there was no evidence for a cell membrane. It's just a conjecture that, you know, how else could it be? You must have a membrane. But there are real concerns about it. One of them being exactly what you brought up, you know, if you breach the membrane, the impact is not so great. And there's one particular experiment where the phenomenon of electroporation, where you put a potential difference across the cell, and it produces gaping holes in what you presume to be the membrane, because if you put large molecules outside, like DNA, they get in, and the DNA is expressed. So the cell is living, obviously, and the DNA is expressed. So, and in one particular manifestation of that experiment, they electroporated the cells, and they waited a full day, 24 hours, and then they put the DNA outside, and it got in. And so it meant that those holes were open for a full day. And, you know, it's a little bit challenging to explain that, because if you assume that an intact membrane is critical, is absolutely necessary to preserve the difference between the outside and the inside of the cell, this experiment disproves it. So, you know, you can either push that, sweep that observation under the carpet and hope that somebody in the future can explain it, or you can say, well, you know, maybe if there's a membrane, maybe the membrane is not so critical. And it might be that the membrane is not so critical. And there even have been challenges to the presence of existence of a cell membrane. For example, it was pointed out, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, British scientist who I think departed the Earth several years ago. And he brought up a point that I think is highly relevant. You know, the first real evidence for the cell membrane came from electron microscopy. And so you can look at the image and in the electron microscope, and what you see is like railroad tracks, uninterrupted, that run all around the cell. And, you know, it was a great big hurrah from everybody, because everybody knew that there must be a cell membrane, and there you have it. However, it's not so clear, because, you know, electron microscopy involves maybe 10 steps in order to go from the living tissue to what you see in the microscope. And each step is subject to artifact. And I apologize, I can't remember his name. It will come to me. But what he brought up is the following observation that is really interesting. If you think of and the observation questions whether the cell membrane is, whether what you're really seeing is a cell membrane or what you're seeing is an artifact of electron microscopy. So if you think of the cell as, let's say, a sphere, and around this sphere at the edge is this membrane that has looks like two railroad tracks. Now, to do electron microscopy, what you do is slice. You take a very thin section. And if you take that thin section at the equator, you get a certain distance, the true distance between those railroad tracks, and it's about 10 nanometers is what is observed. But if you take a slice anywhere else, like let's say at the extreme near one of the poles, then the distance between those two tracks should be much larger, because you're not slicing at the equator and looking down. You're slicing obliquely. However, everybody reports 8 or 10 nanometers. And so this is a conundrum, because it shouldn't be the case. It should be that people report the distance between those two as being variable, not constant, but people report constant. And therefore, his view is that this is an artifact of electron microscopy. It's not the cell membrane. And if he's right, this experiment needs to be repeated. If he's right, it means that there is no evidence for the existence of a cell membrane. It's a conjecture that it must exist to keep the inside separate from the outside. But we just discussed a piece of evidence saying that functionally, it doesn't matter. You can blast holes in the cell membrane, and the cell is perfectly happy. So these are issues, and I'm not suggesting that the issues are resolved one way or the other. What I am suggesting is that it's absolutely necessary to return to this and examine it in objective detail to find out what is truth. It's not so clear what truth is. So I'm sorry, that's a long answer to your short question, but I think the existence of a continuous cell membrane is less secure than we might think.
Yeah, I find it interesting you use the word continuous. And, you know, I remember in the book there were some studies where in the 80s and 90s people were using detergents to break up the membranes and see how long it took the ions to come out. And in one of them in the 90s, it took 8 hours for the potassium to leak out, which, you know, is way, way, way longer than it should if the membrane is the thing separating the ions. And what they noted as well was that the potassium came out in blobs rather than a continuous stream, which is suggestive of the sort of adhesion to this sort of structured gel-like water within the cell.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the whole thing is unclear. There are a bunch of issues that are unclear, but, you know, mostly most of us just take for granted what's in the textbook and go from there. And the problem with that is that if you build on a foundation that's not correct, everything is going to be wrong, or at least very, very complicated, you know, and I think this is where we are right now. That many of us are too timid to challenge what's in the textbook. And there's good reason for it. If you need to run your laboratory and get a grant, you have to toe the line. Because if you, as one critic said, the system of getting grants, it's built on the peer review system. But if you suggest something new, there are no peers, you know, and so you really can't get a fair review. And a lot of scientists who are clever people who do have original ideas, they have a tendency to repress those ideas because it's not good for the financial health of their laboratory. This is real factor.
So where does this idea, because I think the reason it's not challenged is because it's completely just taken for granted that that's true. I mean, I've never read a book on biology that suggests that, you know, there is no continuous cell membrane. It's always just taken for granted that that's there. And then, like you said, this is used as a foundation upon which to build. It's actually quite a strong part of arguments by evolutionary biologists like Nick Lane, talking about the origins of life. It's sort of taken for granted that, the reverse Krebs cycle was generating lipid membranes, and those membranes were creating basically an inside and an outside. And as soon as you separate something with a membrane, you get a charge across the membrane, and that charge could be used to do things. So it's sort of like the foundation of a lot of these ideas, that there is this sort of selectively permeable membrane in all, even protocells before there was DNA, before all of that, that we had these lipid membranes that were creating charge gradients. And that brings up this idea about ion channels. Now, I know this is a contentious issue as well, because I believe Ling looked at the sodium pump, the supposed sodium pump, and found out that there was not enough energy even to just run that pump in the cell. So what's your view on ion channels as well at the moment?
Well, both the pumps and the channels, I think the evidence is against that. And so Ling's point is very, very well taken. You know, he did experiments and he found that even just for the sodium pump, so can't possibly muster the amount of energy that it takes to do all the pumping that would be required. And by now, a student of mine went into the field of pumps and channels and membrane gadgetry, if you will, and told me that by now there are more than 1,000 pumps in the membrane. And, so if you don't have enough energy to run the sodium pump, you certainly don't have enough energy to run all the other pumps that go with it, and it's the same with the channel. Well, the argument is a bit different with the ion channels, but one of the things is that we were talking about electron microscopy of the membrane, and you'd expect to see evidence of these pumps and these channels in the membrane, but you see a continuous, like two railroad tracks running, not interrupted at all. So something's wrong. Where are they? Where are the pumps and where are the channels? Well, so the channel idea runs into real problems. So one problem, a conundrum is this: you've got. In theory, you've got channels for each of many dozens, if not hundreds, of different ions or substances for which there is a particular channel. Now, imagine the channel for the largest solute. Think of it as, say, a basketball or something like that. And the channel opens and it lets the basketball through. But if it opens and lets the basketball through, what about the golf balls and the softballs and the other? Why don't they go through themselves? And for each channel needs to exclude all solutes or ions that are smaller than the one for which it's specific. And this has not been solved. There has been some discussion about sodium and potassium, and a Nobel Prize was given distinguishing the two, but beyond those two, it's a mystery. And it's illogical. It doesn't make any sense at all. And this hasn't been addressed. Well, so there are a bunch of criticisms, and another criticism, one that's rather simple. Think of a cell. The cytoplasm is like a gel, and the membrane surrounds this gel. Well, it turns out that if you take the gel, like the inside, like the cytoplasm, and you stick an electrode in, you measure it like -100 millivolts, same as if you stick it in the cell. So if you get the same electrical potential, when you have no membrane, you're just sticking it into a gel. Does it make sense to say that the origin of all of these activities is in the membrane? It's in the gel. It's in the cytoplasm itself. And so we've gone on. This is not in the Cells, Gels, and Engines of Life book, but we know now, this is in the fourth phase of water book, we know now that the cell is filled with easy water, and easy water typically is negatively charged. So it's very simple, you know, if you think of the cell as a unit, a bag, or what have you, and you fill it with negative charge, of course you stick an electrode in and you measure negative charge or negative electrical potential. You don't need any of this, I hesitate to use the word because it sounds degrading, but membrane gadgetry, I don't know what other terms to use. It made a lot of sense early on, how else are you going to explain it? But now that we know that the cell is filled with easy water, that's where the electrical potential comes from. It's very straightforward. And you were mentioning aging, if the cell has less easy water than for young, healthy people, then the electrical potential will be smaller, less negative. And that's actually true in pathological cells, and especially true in cancer cells. Instead of electrical potential of 50 to 100 millivolts negative, it's only 10 or 15 millivolts negative. And by the way, it turns out that at that electrical potential, cells ordinarily divide. They have a tendency to keep dividing. Experiments done by Clarence Cohn 50 years ago demonstrated that. And many other experiments now, you can find it in various review articles. For every cell, without exception, every cell that keeps dividing, whether it's a cancer cell or whether it's just proliferating cell like embryonic cells, they have very small electrical potential. In my interpretation, they have not enough easy water. They can't function in a normal way, so they're pathological. So anyway, I'm sorry for going on at length on this subject. There are many, many issues that we just presume, because everybody else presumes, we presume they're correct. But I think there are some doubts.
Yeah, well, it's so fascinating. And what you point out with this idea of channels and pores and pumps and so forth, it's not very parsimonious, because every time you discover something new, you have to sort of shoehorn in a new channel that must be there, apparently. Whereas what you're talking about is extremely parsimonious. It seems like something nature would do. You know, let's just do the simplest way to do this. Nature doesn't waste energy on things that it doesn't need. So why do anything different?
Absolutely.
And I think it's true. Even if you make Jell-O, it has a negative potential as well if you stuck an electrode in it. So the membrane is basically, it can be seen as irrelevant in this story. And I presume it must be the components inside the cell, things like the cytoskeleton and the other elements inside the cell that are doing the structuring. They're laying the foundation, the hydrophilic, surfaces, the adsorbents of water to allow that structure to get there. And obviously, as we age, those structures sort of decay, and the capacity for water to adsorb and generate this negative charge goes down. And yeah, like you said, it's funny you point out the that this drop in potential within the cell is a key metric of mitosis, because when I spoke to Gabor Chamalier, he said that the deuterium hydrogen ratio going up is a key trigger for mitosis as well. And even back looking at the biophoton research, we know that when cells divide, they're losing a lot of light through biophotons. So it seems like all of these things are connected. And have you thought about, I know Gabor saw you speak at the end of last year. He told me he was very convinced of your work and that it seems absolutely true what you're saying. Have you been in contact with him and thought about this deuterium hydrogen ratio story?
Well, we've actually started studying deuterium depleted water because it's now important. And we don't have conclusive results, but I haven't been in contact with him and discussing this. But what we're finding so far, this is very preliminary, is that it looks like if you don't have deuterium in the water, the easy is bigger. And that makes sense because if you think of the easy or fourth phase water as a crystal, if the crystals that are pure have the capacity to grow to enormous sizes, but if they're impure, if they have contaminants, and you might look at deuterium as a contaminant, it's only in small quantities, it interrupts the lattice, and so the lattice can't grow as freely as it would ordinarily grow. And so that kind of makes sense. I have to emphasize that the results are highly preliminary, done by a student, and the student is graduating before finishing the study. So we're not yet sure of the result. It's an interesting topic to study, and it's becoming very important.
Yeah, I guess it's going to become important because we need to understand. From what I understand from Gabor, in the mitochondria, the deuterium level is substantially lower, and this probably leads to different water dynamics within the mitochondria compared to the cytoplasm. And presumably this has an effect on the quantum coherence within the mitochondria, which is where a lot of, electron and proton tunneling is supposed to be going on between the complexes. Is the quantum effects and how water affects them, is this something that you've looked into?
I have no understanding whatsoever of quantum mechanics. The word quantum is bandied about by everybody, almost everybody. And then when I ask the question, well, could you explain to me? Dead silence. So it seems that the word has become so fashionable. But quantum mechanics is essentially abstract mathematics is really what it is.
Yeah.
And when I think of Mother Nature, I think did Mother Nature decide to revert to from the principle of simplicity, which you mentioned earlier, to abstract mathematics? I wonder. And so I'm sorry, but I really have nothing to say about quantum this or quantum that because I simply don't understand it. I have not the mathematical background to delve deeply into the field of quantum mechanics. And so sorry about that.
No, I'm very sympathetic to that view. There's no way I will ever understand it either. But it seems quite interesting that more people are looking into whether there are quantum effects going on in the mitochondria and so forth. So.
But what are those quantum effects? I don't understand.
I think it's mostly looking at, for example, complex one has all of these reaction cores within the protein itself, and it looks like the electrons are being tunneled from one complex to the next. So instead of going, randomly through different places, they simultaneously go to all these different places and then they find the core, and then that collapses the wave function and then they go straight to the core. It's similar, from my understanding, it's similar to what's happening in the quantum model of photosynthesis, where the photon is taking all the paths to the reaction core simultaneously and it finds the shortest route and uses that, which I have no idea how to explain how that's going on, but apparently that's true.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Buy that. Thank you. That's very helpful. Yeah, but I'm sorry. I can't contribute to that discussion.
That's okay. There's plenty more I want to discuss with you. One of them being ATP and what Ling termed as the cardinal adsorbent. And I think this is something we touched on last time we spoke. And in your book, I found a reference from Podolsky and Morales in 1955. And they basically looked at this high energy bond and how much energy you could get from the hydrolysis of that high energy bond in ATP. And at the end of their paper, I don't understand the whole paper, obviously, but at the end they say, you know, we found no evidence that there is a high energy bond in ATP. And I think it was 1962 when Ling put out his idea that basically what ATP was a site for water to adsorb and generate this charge separation event, which you later called this EZ water. And I was wondering, how does the adsorption of water to the high negative charge of that ATP correlate to getting work done? How does it correlate to generating energy?
Well, I mean, if you take the Podolsky and Morales paper, it was a long time ago. And by the way, when I started my career, Podolsky offered a postdoc in his laboratory. So I know these guys pretty well. And, you know, sophisticated scientists. And yep. Indeed, they found there's nothing special, no special energy about, no high energy phosphate. They did cover their tracks a bit, saying they're not challenging anything here, but they obviously are challenging a lot. So you have to ask the question, you know, if they're right, if indeed there's no such thing as a high energy phosphate, then you have to ask the question, well, where does the energy come from? And I would like to suggest that that at least some of the energy, perhaps even all of the energy, is electrical in nature, because you know, the essence of the fourth phase water is the separation of charge. So what happens is you start with uncharged water, liquid water molecule, and in the presence of infrared energy, just like the first step of photosynthesis, the water molecule breaks into negative and positive components. And it's like a battery, minus and plus at one end. And we demonstrated that this separation of charge has the capacity to do work. In a paper that was just published about 4 or 5 months ago, we saw that this occurs. One example is in the cardiovascular system, where to everyone's surprise, if you stop the heart, the flow doesn't stop. And there are a half dozen papers that support this, published throughout the last 100 years or so. And we confirmed it in an experimental paper. My student Zheng Li did this experiment. And so if that's true, you have to ask the question, well, you know, if the blood keeps flowing but the heart's not pumping, it's got to be something else that's driving the blood. And we found that what it is the phenomenon of EZ, of charge separation. In the laboratory, we found that if we took tubes that sort of look just like an artery or a vein, and we hydrophilic material, immerse it in water, the water flows through the tube like through a straw, just keeps going. It doesn't stop. We've had it going for as much as a day and a half without stopping, and we know how to make it go essentially indefinitely. And so, so we thought that this could possibly be the source of energy for driving the flow in the cardiovascular system above and beyond the heart. And we tested it, and we found indeed that that seemed to be the case. So this is one example of the use of EZ water, because we found in these immersed tubes that the reason for the flow is that the water inside gets broken up into negative EZ and positive protons. And these positive protons, which exist in the core of the vessel, they repel each other. And they want to get out of the tube, and so they go either in one direction or the other direction. And it seems that the same thing is occurring in your cardiovascular system and my cardiovascular system. So this is just one example of how charge separation is involved in driving a very fundamental process in the cardiovascular system. And the same thing in cells, and in basically all cells, if the cells are filled with EZ water, you've got a lot of negative charges inside the cell, and those negative charges repel each other. That repulsion is potential energy, and that potential energy could be used, and I believe it is used. So there's a possible potential, I use the same word, potential energy, potential for a good deal of the energy that we have, if not all of the energy. We can't say that, we don't know that, but a very substantial fraction of the energy to come not from chemical energy of high energy phosphate in ATP, which as you comment has been challenged, from there to the use of maybe or exploitation of electrical energy. So our bodies may actually be electrical machines.
Yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense. Again, it's a bit more of a parsimonious approach, Occam's razor. You know, you want to try and explain things as simply as possible, and it seems like that's kind of what nature does. What ATP is still important. It's just setting up the initial conditions in which water can set the stage for all of these things to happen. And I think protein folding is another one that's highly reliant on the transition of water between this sort of more ordered state and less ordered state, and that's what's helping these proteins shape. And even through mitosis, the sort of cytokinesis seems to be being done by the shift in water from sort of bulk to EZ, and that's having an effect on the way the protein folds. So it's not that crazy to think that all of this work is being done by this sort of phase transition or this charge separation of water, rather than, like you said, getting chemical energy from a single molecule.
I'm right with you on that. It's logical, it makes sense, and as you say eloquently, it's parsimonious.
Yeah,
it really is parsimonious, and that, you know, that's a good sign if we accept Occam's razor. And I think we have, mostly scientists, since the time of, actually it was Newton, because Occam, if you look at the history, Occam, he was a theologian. He was interested in the existence of God. Mm. And he said there are two approaches or two ideas, and one is that God exists, and the other is God doesn't exist. And he said the way to figure out what the truth is to figure out which hypothesis is simpler. And that'll be the one that's correct. And a few hundred years later, it was Isaac Newton who thought, hey, you know, this is a pretty good idea. It should apply to science as well. Mm. And a lot of scientists took up the idea and used it. And it makes perfect sense to me that's how nature operates. Right now, it appears to operate in very complicated ways. If you open any textbook on cell biology, the complexity is daunting. And I mentioned earlier, I think, you know, if the foundation on which you build is not the right foundation, every mechanism is going to be really complicated. And if it's really complicated, it's a good sign that you haven't identified the right foundation. So I think we need to go back and re-examine our foundation. And it's almost impossible to do that, because if you want to keep your laboratory funded, That's not the way to go about doing it. And, you know, after all, the people in the laboratory need to eat. They need to get salaries. And sometimes the principal investigator also needs to put hamburgers on the table. You need money to do that. And it's not easy to get money if your ideas run counter to the mainstream, counter to the people who are reviewing your application. You challenge them and they bite. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. Common sense.
Yeah, I read a great book called Science Fictions, largely about the replication crisis in science. And this guy talks about seeing a study that was published and he wanted to repeat it. And he repeated it and found that it was completely the opposite result that the first publication found. So he went and tried to get this published in the same journal. And the journal said, "We don't publish replication results." And he's saying, "I just proved them wrong. What do you mean you're not going to publish my paper?" So, you know, there's a lot going on, a lot of hoops to jump through lots of bumps in the road to try and even challenge an idea that's clearly wrong. Who's going to fund you going back and doing old work that's set in stone? No one needs to go back and look at it anymore. It's a really big problem. I was going to ask you if you knew about the work of Mike Levin at Tufts University.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah. It seems to be something that I think fits quite well with what you're doing, this idea of bioelectricity being and the electric fields being the thing that guide morphological growth, for instance. And I know you're friends with Rupert Sheldrake, and I think Rupert's ideas fit quite well with what Mike is doing. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts based on Mike Levin's work, whether your ideas fit in with his at all.
Well, I guess I don't know his work well enough to comment, but all I can say is that electrical phenomena, I think, are dominant. Everything we've seen implies that electric fields are so important for everything. In fact, my next book that is coming out, it's called Charged, as the main title, and the unsuspected role of electricity in the workings of nature. And I think that it's not only in our bodies that electrical charge is so dominant, but in phenomena that we see and we notice every day, but we don't really think about. So I cover issues, 19 chapters dealing with various issues in nature that we think we understand, but really we don't understand. For example, weather. I've seen hypothesis even that describes how you go from basic physical principles to hurricanes or tornadoes. It's simply not understood. And I make an attempt to understand it. And the critical variable is charge, is electrical charge. I spent 4 chapters developing an idea of, for example, you think of a cloud up there. The cloud is full of water, little droplets of water. And if you were to climb a tall ladder and take a pail of water and turn it over, you know, you'd get wet if you're standing beneath it. But yet the cloud is hovering above. So what keeps it up there? And I come to the conclusion that it's electrical charge that is involved. The earth is negatively charged. The clouds are negatively charged. They repel each other. It's not complicated, but I provide the evidence that this is the case. So it's not only that, but I deal with, for example, planes that are flying. So you think you understand what are the principles of flying, but you'd be surprised. There was a Scientific American article. And Scientific America is not known for its radical stances on anything. You know that they sing the familiar tune, and so to my great surprise, there was an article on flying, and it was written by two people who were considered to be the experts in the field. And the title of the piece is, I think, something like How Planes Fly. And the subtitle, you know, in smaller letters just underneath, is something like, Believe It or Not, Even the Experts Don't Know How Planes Fly. And that's a surprise because everybody thinks, you know, everything about flying must be known, but it's not known. So, you know, there's Bernoulli's principle that has to do with the shape of the upper side of the wing versus the lower. And, you know, the thinking is that's what keeps the plane up, but planes can fly upside down. So if that's what keeps the plane up, the upside down planes should plummet, but they don't. Mm-hmm. They perfectly will. So there's got to be something else. And if you start thinking about that, and again, I believe that electrical charges are critical. The same thing with birds, you know, how do birds fly? And so if a child were to ask you how, you'd probably say, well, they flap their wings. Well, I don't know if you'd say that because you're a sophisticated guy, but most people would. But on the other hand, I look out my window where I'm sitting right now, and every day I see eagles flying. They have a nest nearby, and mostly they don't flap their wings at all. And they so-called glide. So they'll glide at constant altitude. Sometimes they'll descend. Sometimes they'll ascend. They'll go into the wind, against the wind, perpendicular to the wind. And they do this every day. And so the idea that flapping of wings is responsible for all this, doesn't work because they don't flap their wings mostly. Mm. So what's involved? And I argue about the role of electrical charge being there. And I go as far as sailboats. You're from Australia, therefore you must do a lot of sailing. I'm not sure if you do, but
I've never sailed.
Oh, okay. Well, I make the false assumption that anybody from Australia must be a sailor. Not true. So anyway, you can imagine, though, sailing downwind is trivial, right? The wind fills the sail, pushes the boat down. But sailboats can go upwind, too. And the extreme of that, which you may not know about because it's too warm in Australia, are the ice boats. So the ice boats look just like sailboats, except they run on skids like sleds instead of being immersed in the water. And they go almost directly into the wind. Now, so if you think about that, it doesn't make any sense at all. Mm. Because if I'm pushing you, you're going to go backwards. You're not going to come toward me. But these boats do the opposite. And so the sailors who are there, they feel the wind on their face. And they could go at speeds of 100 miles an hour easily. And they go against the wind, almost directly against the wind. That doesn't make any sense at all. According to Newton, they should go in the opposite direction. It needs to be explained. And again, electrical charges, I think, are involved, and I explain how. What I'm trying to say is that the idea that electrical forces are dominant in nature, I believe is true not only in biology, but also beyond biology and everything that is existing around us. We just need to pay more attention to it.
Do you think that this phenomena was what Schauberger was observing with the trout swimming upstream, even though they looked like they were basically stationary, but they could swim against the current, like almost like without swimming at all? Do you think this is the same sort of phenomenon?
I do, because so Schauberger didn't talk about this, but again, I deal with swimming in the book, and I think it also has to do with charges. So it turns out that, you know, fish take in water from their mouths, and they expel the water from the lateral gill slits, you know, those curved slits on the side. And the water that comes out is positively charged. Measurements have been made of this. So what happens that the water gets split, the incoming water gets split by the gills, and the fish use the negative charge, the way we use negative charge, and it gets rid of the protons or gets rid of the positive charge through those gill slits. And you can imagine and the gill slits expelling charged water. And if the charges are expelled backwards, the fish will go forward. And I think that's what actually drives the fish locomotive. It's electrical charge. So yes, I think the trout, you know, you'd expect if the trout gets scared in some way, it's going to go downstream, but it goes upstream. Mm. And I think this is exactly the method that the trout uses to go upstream.
That's so fascinating. I wish Schauberger was alive, because I think a conversation between you and him would be so fascinating.
I love it. Well, his grandson is alive and kicking and has formed a museum.
Yes.
He's actually coming to our water conference. We have an annual conference on the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. And this year it's going to be in the middle of October in Lisbon. Nice place to come. Very exciting. And he's going to give a talk.
I'm hoping to be there this year.
Well, sure. Absolutely.
We'll see.
Yeah. Okay.
Speaking of charge, I want to ask you about the ATPase, because this is sort of this nano rotor. Apparently it spins at about 7,800 RPM when it's working. And this is generating, no doubt, quite a large electric field. Something I learned from reading Mei Wan Ho was that water has quite a high dielectric constant, which means, to my understanding, that it's very easily polarized by an electric field. It seems to me that though, as though the charges in the mitochondria, these, you know, really powerful charge densities, are creating ordered water, maybe just through the exposure of an electromagnetic through an electric field. Is this something that might be playing a role in energy generation and something that's important with regard to water in the mitochondria?
Well, in terms of the ATPase, if ATP is not the energetic source, then it's a red herring, really, as to what's going on there. But in the mitochondria, the electrical potential is very high, and it's got all these membranes inside. And so the architecture of it is just right to create easy water. Mm. So I think what's going on is that the mitochondria are creating easy water with a lot of negative charge. And the question is, how is this negative charge or easy water, how is it used? And I think it's used in the following way. So you mentioned the phase transition, and in the book that you mentioned, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, I present essentially half of the book is filled with evidence that the cell action involves a phase transition. So you go from structured water, we say now easy water, fourth phase water, and extended proteins. And the phase transition occurs, the water undergoes a change from easy water to ordinary water. And then the proteins undergo folding, and the folding of the proteins is what essentially does the work of the cell. And in muscle cells, it's responsible for contraction, et cetera. But then it has to return. It has to return to water that's ordinary liquid water to easy water. And the proteins need to get extended. And that return requires negative charge, because it either needs easy water to get infused in the cell, or negative charge, because we know from experiments that if you infuse negative charge into water, it builds easy water. And so where does this negative charge come from? It needs to be it needs to come rapidly. And I think it comes from the mitochondria. I think that is perhaps the real role of the mitochondria, to build easy water and then extract the negative charge from the easy water to fill the cell and return the cell to its initial condition. Otherwise, if the mitochondria are not working properly, not working well, the cell won't return. So if you think of a muscle cell, if you exert yourself, your muscles will remain contracted. They don't remain relaxed. You'll have a knot in your muscle. And the knot occurs because the contracting cell is not returned to its initial relaxed state, which involves easy water. There somehow is a dearth of electrons, and the mitochondria aren't doing their job as effectively. So that would be my conjecture at the moment, because we don't have a lot of evidence, conjecture as to how the mitochondria are behaving. You know, and in muscle cells, muscles do a lot of work, and so there are a lot of mitochondria because you need to supply a lot of that energy. So I think it doesn't really have anything to do with ATP, possibly. Again, it needs to be studied, but I think it has to do with electricity, with electrical charges, and used in a way that we haven't previously thought of.
Yeah, I mean, that would kind of make sense. A lot of things that prolong life are actually appear to be mitochondrial uncouplers. So they actually allow the charge gradient to flow back against and not generate ATP, but actually stop generating ATP. And I always thought, isn't that weird? Wouldn't you expect longer life to be associated with more ATP? But a lot of these uncouplers actually prolong life. So things like all these plant hormetic compounds that they stop the mitochondria from producing ATP. And by doing that, they actually help control reactive oxygen species generation. And you think, well, isn't it weird that you're still able to generate energy, but even though ATP production might be slowing down even on a local level. So it is interesting. If the energy is not coming from ATP, then you can see what that uncoupling is doing is trying to balance the charges within the mitochondria and the cell, which comes back to trying to establish the right electric fields and the electrical potential throughout the whole cell.
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. What you're alluding to is that biology is an electrical machine, is not a chemical machine. And I think that's a direction for the future. It needs seriously to be studied. There aren't enough people who are devoting much of their electrical energy to studying that. It needs to be done.
I know Veda Austin spoke at your last water conference last year. How do you see her work playing into what you're doing? I spoke to her couple of years ago now, I think, and it seems that something about, you know, our consciousness or whatever you want to call it is impacting how water is behaving. Is this something that you've noticed experimentally as well, that, you know, our thoughts might be impacting the way that water is behaving?
We're studying that right now. We invite healers to our laboratory, and they impart their healing energy to a container of water. And we examine the water before and after to see if there are any physical chemical changes. And so ongoing studies, we have no definitive results yet. But yeah, I mean, we actually wouldn't be doing this experiment if we didn't think there's something to it. It all harks back to the idea of memory of water or information water. And I think you're probably aware of the work of the late Jacques Benveniste, whose career was demolished because he had evidence that water had memory, and it seemed impossible from the point of view of most conventional thinkers, and it's a long story, but basically, his career was demolished, and he died prematurely. He was despondent because he was a famous scientist with a laboratory of 50 people, and it went to zero, and he barely could struggle. He became a scientific joke. So his experiments have been repeated and confirmed by various other people. At our conference, he's a hero, and. I guess there had been experiments before his, but his are perhaps best known. And there are lots of other people studying information, memory of water. Another one is Luc Montagnier, who passed last year. He was a friend of Jacques. When Jacques died, he began doing experiments. And his experimental results, if valid, are amazing. I could describe if you like, but basically he demonstrated a very sophisticated kind of memory of water. He was not popular for that, even though he won a Nobel Prize for discovering HIV. He came to our conference annually for a decade or so. And his results are stunning. They've been now confirmed in three different laboratories and published. And so it looks as though the experiments are valid. And many other people, each year, two or three people come to the conference and discuss information, memory, and such of water. And Veda Austin's work fits into that. I remember when she was first getting started, she came to my home in Seattle, and she asked me, she said, okay, I'm putting this water in front of you. Think of some theme. And I thought of a house. So she put the water in my freezer, and 10 minutes later, she took it out. There was a thin film of ice, and the ice contained roof lines that looked like this. So it looked like a house. I was astonished. She's done so many experiments since then, and her stuff has become very popular. And she's coming to our conference, and I mentioned to her this is a scientific conference, and scientists demand repeatability. And so I invited her to come only if she would demonstrate the repeatability that she claims is the case. I think it's there. I'm waiting to see what evidence she has, but she told me personally that these, she gets images doing various intentional kinds of things, and she said they're absolutely repeatable. So we'll see. For scientists, repeatability is key, and so I'm expecting her to show repeatable experiments in the middle of October in Lisbon. Her stuff is just amazing. It's fascinating, and a lot of people have. She has a lot of followers. People have taken up that work. And so I think there are a lot of, if you use the expression, believers in that work. You know, it's easy to be skeptical. It's just so interesting what she's got.
Yeah, and I think the whole water memory thing just goes to show not even a Nobel Prize will protect you from criticism. It's really unfortunate because a lot of people just, you know, people who aren't scientists are doing what Veda is doing and getting incredible results as well. And I think repeatability, Veda takes it to the next level. I think she says, or at least she told me that unless she gets 50, 50 examples of the same thing with the same prompt, she doesn't consider it strong enough evidence. So she's been working very, very hard. But yeah, it's a bit of a weird sort of field to try and get into. I've heard you mention on another podcast the work of Arturo Solis Herrera and his ideas about the generation of energy through this sort of similar to a photosynthetic pathway using melanin. Now, I know your work is obviously, the interaction between water and infrared light is the main thing that is driving the EZ. And I was wondering how seriously to consider this idea that energy or work was being done by the interaction between light. I mean, we all know that you feel better when you go outside and you're in the sunlight. Why that is, it's, you know, probably lots of things going on, but do you think his ideas hold any water?
So to speak, water. I'm not sure. He sent us some samples, and we tried to we immersed some of the melanin in water, and we're looking for EZs, and we were unable to find EZs. That's not a definitive test of anything. But I know that he's been pursuing this avidly, and in fact, in his city, it's called Aguas Calieras or something. I forget. In Mexico, he runs the Center for the center for human photosynthesis. And if you really think about it, that's what photosynthesis does. You know, it's light that splits water. And that's what he's talking about, light that splits water. So while his work is audacious and interesting, it's not unexpected that that you would find an energetic source. And I think he's developing the energetic source for practical use, although I haven't followed that part of it. It's very interesting, and it would be cool if other people began repeating his experiments and confirming and extending. So yeah, this is exciting stuff.
Has he shown mechanistically that melanin is involved in the splitting of water? Have they actually shown that in a study?
I don't think that it's been shown in a study. I haven't followed it precisely. He's a kind of enthusiastic guy who sometimes runs at a speed that's far ahead of the rest of us, and sometimes a few of the details are missing along the way.
Yeah.
But it seems that he's got something really interesting. And, you know, I always revert back to the first step of photosynthesis. It's light. And that's what we're talking about. Light. The energy from light is really what does this transduction. It takes water and splits the water into positive and negative. That's the first step of photosynthesis.
Yeah.
And the first step is said to be 100% efficient. So this is what we found, maybe more generically, infrared light incident on the water and next to a hydrophilic interface, it breaks up the water into negative and positive. And the one thing that we've discovered that the photosynthesis people have not discovered, if you think about it, you know, if you put in light, first step of photosynthesis, and it breaks up the water into plus and minus don't like to be separated. They want to come right back together again.
Yeah.
At least I learned that in middle school, plus and minus attract one another. So what the field of photosynthesis has not addressed is what keeps the plus and the minus apart from each other. Now, in our construct, we know that because when the EZ forms, it's a very dense structure and negatively charged. And the positive charges, of course, want desperately to get in, but they can't get in because it's too dense. So they're kept separated. And I sometimes wondered whether the same thing happens in that first step of photosynthesis, that although they haven't identified it, that's exactly what's going on, that it's a variation of what we found to be more general about the splitting of water and development of EZ. Same thing might be occurring in the first step of photosynthesis, but hasn't been recognized. That remains to be studied in the future.
That's fascinating. I've been speaking recently with some scientists, optic engineers, astrophysicists who have become very interested in the change in our lighting environments and the phasing out and
I'm
banning
sorry, change
most-
I- In here.
Of our lighting environments.
Change in what? In
the lighting environments that we have indoors.
Okay.
And the movement from the old incandescent bulbs, the tungsten filaments, to LEDs with no near infrared and infrared light at all. And of course, because we don't see those wavelengths, you know, we think it's all the same. But it's very clear that our loss of those critical wavelengths is really impacting the way our cells are working. And it seems to me as though, you know, we're not being exposed to infrared light very much anymore. The average person spends over 90% of their time indoors. And because we're indoors now with LED lights, we don't have any long wavelength lights inside at all. And I'm wondering, I think I know your answer, but I presume this is causing all sorts of problems with aging and diseases of aging, because essentially the cells aren't able to use this energy to create the EZ water within the cell and even in the extracellular matrix for that matter. And I presume this is causing a lot of problems.
Anything that deviates from nature is bound to cause problems. I guess we could leave it at that. You know, so many of us have chronic illnesses. It's a really serious issue, and the more we deviate from what's natural, the more we acquire these chronic problems. And so, I think some of us have come to realize that that's the case, and others of us don't ever think about that. It's a problem. I guess I don't have anything more to say about that.
I couldn't have said it better myself, and I definitely will quote you on that, because that's a really, really nice way to put it. Before I wrap up, I wanted to ask you, you know, this, the Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life was published a long time ago. Has anything changed that maybe shapes the information in that book? Has anything sort of changed your opinion over the last 20 odd years?
Only one, thing, which actually makes it simpler, and that is I refer in that book to structured water, because the book was actually intended to make Gilbert Ling's ideas palatable or understandable. And Gilbert was talking about structured water, not with regard to any possible electrical charge that it had. His idea was that it's the water molecules that are piled up, stacked on one another, that is the structure. And that's what I assumed when I wrote that book. And later, when we started doing experiments, we found that the structured water, which we called easy water or fourth phase water, generally has negative charge. And so if I were to rewrite the book, that would be essentially the only change I would make. And it turns out actually to be simpler that way, because it explains more. And I won't go into detail on that right here, but that's the only change, the only major change that I would make. Of course, there are references that could be updated.
Is it true that copper generates a positive EZ zone?
Yeah, so we looked at various metals, and the metals seem to be the exception. And we found that next to metallic surfaces, EZ grows, and the EZ is actually positively charged, not negatively charged. And the region beyond that positively charged EZ is negatively charged. So it's the inverse of what happens throughout biology and in many other places. I don't talk about it much because it's a, I wouldn't say it's an anomaly, but it doesn't happen very, very often. Mm-hmm. And it also raises questions about the explanation of the exclusion zone. But I think the same general mechanism to describe the structure of the exclusion zone could explain both the negative and positive exclusion zones. In biology, it's always negative. And so if we're talking about biology, we talk about negatively charged exclusion zones.
That's a great place to finish up. I've taken enough of your time, and I'm so grateful that you've given me some of your time. You know, they say never meet your heroes, but I'm absolutely wrong. I couldn't be happier. We've had two chances to talk now.
Thank you, Cameron. I really appreciate your kind words, and thank you for those penetrating questions. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you want to know more about Jerry and his work, I encourage you to find the links in the episode notes. Jerry has also done countless podcasts and has some wonderful presentations on YouTube. If you'd like to support me, please feel free to subscribe to the podcast, as it really helps me grow the channel and get more incredible guests to speak with. I also have a Substack that I use to go even deeper into these podcast topics and offer my thoughts and ideas. This is the best way to keep up to date with my work while also supporting the podcast. I've left some links below where you can follow me on social media, where I share a lot of health-related information. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.